Well, let's see. I think you're probably familiar with this video.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. He just ran over that guy's head with his bicycle.
Video from Wednesday night's protests in Seattle showing an officer walking his bike over a man's head as he lay on the ground, apparently in protest, has been viewed millions of times now, and the officer who did it is now on leave, and Colleen has an update on that investigation.
Well, the investigation has been handed over to the King County Sheriff's Office. The Office of Police Accountability, or OPA, led by civilians, requested a criminal probe into this for possible criminal misconduct, and it was granted, though it's unclear how long it will take for that investigation to play out. The officer, meantime, is on leave, but has not been identified. The incident caught on video by multiple people.
This person is on the ground. He just ran over his head. He just ran over his head.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
And it clearly shows the officer walking the bike over the man, both wheels rolling over his head. It happened as bike police began advancing on protesters on Pine Street near Broadway. People were out reacting to Breonna Taylor's grand jury decision that night. About 300 protesters were attacking police, throwing rocks, glass bottles, fireworks at them. In another now viral video from that night, one protester is seen swinging a bat and cracking an officer over the head. The officer was wearing a helmet. So it was a violent night. Now, there are reports that the protester run over by the police bike is Trumpet Man. That's a nickname given to the person seen at many protests playing the trumpet. Seattle police have not said if he was injured by the officer's actions. According to the Seattle Times, both Seattle Fire and Harborview say they didn't treat anyone for those types of injuries. Interestingly, though, police did arrest Trumpet Man for failure to disperse and obstruction.
So, I guess we still have to wait for more information on that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, multiple media outlets tried to reach out to the man known as Trumpet Man mm-hmm. and haven't heard back. So we haven't heard all sides of the story yet, but SPD acknowledges the video. The investigation is happening, so we'll see what happens.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And joining us, the host of CBS's Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. Margaret, is the president serious about this idea of not conceding a close election?
Well, not conceding versus peaceful transfer of power, two different things. I think what the president is leaning into here, and certainly his top aides are as well, is this idea that November is going to be messy and likely the outcome of the election will be taken to court. He is already laying the groundwork for objecting to the processes in some states by which they are counting votes, mail-in votes in particular. He's sowing distrust about the outcome of the election before we even get to November 3rd. So that is extraordinary. The president has also not committed to peaceful transfer of power. On that front, Republican lawmakers are quietly trying to reassure the public, saying, look, don't pay attention to what he says. Look at what he does. And the sort of wheels of our democracy will continue to turn January 20th. Whoever is officially elected will take office.
I see. Well, that's nice. But for the Senate, apparently, run by Republicans, saw fit to pass a resolution endorsing the peaceful transfer of power, mm-hmm. which kind of surprised me. Never thought I'd live to see that. But, you know, that would even be brought into question. So why'd they do that?
Because it was brought into question, because the president uh-huh. says things. But, I mean, 4 years now, just about every week, we have Republican lawmakers say, don't pay attention to what he says, pay attention to what he does. And these kind of quiet ways, somewhat non-confrontational, such as a, you know, non-enforceable resolution saying we, you know, want this to be peaceful, is a way by which they can send a confidence-building measure to the public without saying, President Trump, you're wrong.
Okay, what about these other scenarios I'm hearing about if the votes in a particular state, let's say Pennsylvania, are called into question because a lot of ballots were thrown out because mm-hmm. of lack of a sleeve or something like that, that the state legislature could just pick its own slate of electors and throw out the entire vote as corrupt, and the electors then, their loyalties would be determined by whoever runs the state legislature.
We're all about to get very familiar with the processes in the battleground states. We already have lawsuits and we already have both campaigns lawyering up in anticipation of problems at the state level. We already have efforts to change the date by which mail-in votes, for example, could even begin to be counted. You had a probe this week opened into, I think it was 9 ballots that came into question in the state of Pennsylvania. But keep in mind, bigger picture, the FBI director testified under oath to Congress this week that he has not seen any signs of large-scale voter fraud. Could you have problems in tabulating results? Yes. Could it take longer than a day? Could it take weeks? Yes. And all of us are trying to prepare the public and trying to prepare ourselves for that outcome.
We've gotten used to it here in Washington. We've been voting by mail for years, and election night is rarely decisive. You see substantial changes in the results over time. So what's your feeling on this? I mean, I've come to take it for granted, but based on the concerns that I'm hearing from Washington, D.C., this is going to be a radical change for most of America.
In that, you know, those states like yours that have actually done it before, I think there's less concern about it's the four or so others. I live in the District of Columbia, which will be proactively sending ballots for the first time to voters. Mm-hmm. So there, on a first time out in the midst of a pandemic with a higher volume, could it be more complicated? Probably. But are the states and local officials up to it? That's another matter. There's also that question of, you know, can the post office be counted on? I mean, we're questioning things that we've never questioned before as a country in terms of the integrity of our institutions and processes. And that's maybe that's part of a healthy democracy. It's also deeply worrying to me that we have such widespread distrust of institutions because those things don't dissipate. November 4th, this is something that even if President Trump loses, Joe Biden will inherit. And this is really kind of a worrisome trend long term. If you can't begin to trust public health officials or, you know, even state and local officials on how they process things, this is worrisome for our democracy.
Now, speaking of public health, what's with the CDC webpage? Lines appear, they disappear. Has anybody been able to find out who is, you know, who's authorized to do this?
Well, one official who is involved in some of these edits, Michael Caputo, has been pushed out. He left for medical leave. So that element has been removed from the equation. CDC officials and the sort of scientists and establishment are pushing back. And that is why you are seeing these reports surface. So, you know, the White House can issue its own political statements. The problem is when the public health agencies in which the public needs to trust, like the CDC, when those things start getting edited for political reasons, that's a real problem.
Yeah. I know I asked you this last week about the vaccine, but there of course, there was more controversy over that. And I think Governor Cuomo asserted that he is now the final authority on whether the vaccine is safe enough for New Yorkers. So is this going to go state by state?
Oh, God. No. And, you know, they're all puffing up their chests to a certain extent. You know, the president said that as well. And I put your question to Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner, on Sunday's show, because I think that's an important thing to clarify to the public. Like, what is the process? How does this actually work? Yeah. And his opinion, as someone who knows it from having run the agency itself, was no. You know, this takes weeks, if not months, to go through a process. And by the way, they would need a pharmaceutical company to be complicit in greenlighting something that they knew that they didn't have faith was safe. And it's just not in a company's interest. That's a very short-term thing. Why would they completely torpedo trust in their own companies and all their products by doing that? Because, of course, we would all question everything about those companies and those institutions should that
stock price
take place. Absolutely. All the boards of the companies would have to be complicit and agree to doing that. So you really have to go pretty far with the conspiracy to believe that this could work. Again, the president says things and frankly may not know how the bureaucratic wheels turn on this front.
Okay. So I will trust that there will be a peaceful transition of power and a safe vaccine.
And that it will be a really complicated and difficult November. You can bank on that.
Margaret Brennan, host of CBS's Face the Nation. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Have you read some of the scenarios of how the election could turn out? I don't know if you heard Bernie Sanders' speech yesterday, but he basically talked about a situation where on election night, it looks like Trump wins because apparently, I haven't seen the stats on this, so I'm just, you know, relaying what other people have said, that more Republicans vote in person than Democrats. So on election night, the in-person vote, which will come in real time, makes it look like Trump wins. Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, here in Washington State, things change the next day as you count more ballots, the people right. who dropped them in the mail just to get the postmark on time, right? And so this will drag on. But before the total number of ballots is counted, the president will say, I've won, based on the live vote. And then as the ballots come in, since he's set us up to believe that it's all fraudulent, they'll charge fraud and start challenging the vote state by state, with the possibility that in Republican states, if you can create enough doubt, apparently the Constitution allows the legislature to throw out the vote, elect its own slate of electors, who would presumably be loyal to whoever controls the legislature, and those would be the votes that count.
Are we just addicted to the drama at this point? Let's just say there's going to be a winner election night, because early voting has already brought out record number of voters. And
so you're in favor of just declaring the victor on election night and not waiting for the rest of the votes to be counted?
If enough ballots have been counted.
Who determines that?
The secretaries of state.
The secretaries, collectively, they get together?
I just think a scenario that takes longer than a minute to explain mm-hmm. is a symptom of being addicted to the drama of the last four
okay.
years.
All right.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Every Friday, our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. But this week, it's about the symbol of a local place, because Spokane really needs your help to come up with a new design for its city flag. Hello, Felix.
Hey, morning, Dave. Yeah, like many American cities, including Seattle, Spokane has a current flag that fails one or more of the five principles of good flag design, as laid out by the North American Vexillological Association and Portland-based flag expert Ted Kay. Now, the three most important rules are these. Keep it simple so a child could draw it from memory. No lettering or seals. You know, all the iconic flags in the world are symbolic. There's no writing. And use meaningful symbolism. That is, recognizable shapes that work from a distance while a piece of fabric is swaying in the breeze. Hmm. And symbolism is really tricky because you can't necessarily explain what it means. It takes a while for it to catch on. Did you get a chance to look at the Spokane flag that I
did?
You?
It looks like a cheap T-shirt.
Yeah, it's got like a symbol. It looks like sort of a certificate of appreciation.
Yeah,
this little family
of four
people.
It's supposed to be a sun, I think. It's like, yeah, a good conduct
seal. Spokane means people of the sun. The native term is where the city's name comes from. Anyway, some cities have great flag designs and citizens really embrace them. Vexillologist, let me get that straight. Ted Kay says Chicago's a great example of this. Big stripes and stars representing the bodies of water and big events in the city's history. Portland flag is loved by people too and used by people. But Spokane's launched an official effort to replace their flag. They've got about 110 submissions so far. They want to get to 150 by October 15th. So they've extended the deadline that far. They're going to let people vote on all of them, kind of rate all 150, and then vote on the top 10 later in 2021. You'll have to have a Spokane library card in order to vote, because they want to avoid the sort of flaggy McFlagface incident that could be possible.
They don't want any vote fraud.
Yeah, or they don't want some, and the submissions, they'll post everything except things that are obscene, of course. So there's still time if people living in this area want to help Spokane come up with a new flag. They'll take any design you send them as long as it's not obscene and let people vote on it. We'll have all the links and stuff at My Northwest, but you can send us a text if you have some good ideas at 98973, because you have to have a good design, then people have to embrace it. Because if you have a great design and there's only one copy and it's just hanging in City Hall,
right,
no one's going to care. It's got to be embraced by people at soccer games and football games, and has to be hung in front of people's homes and stuff. So it's a tricky process, but it's worth doing. Seattle tried this a year ago unofficially, and it just kind of died. The Stranger and the Seattle Times did some efforts on, online, but nothing became of it. So Spokane's going to be a different place, different part of the state, less cynical, I think. So they'll probably have a better time coming up with a flaggy McFlag for Spokane.
Flaggy McFlag, yeah. You want to try that word again, Felix?
Vexillologist.
Very good. And it's somebody who studies flags, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Learn a new word every day, and you'll always have work. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
6:49. So, never say never, right? Looks like there's going to be an Apple Cup this year after all. The Pac-12 has decided to return to football after calling off the season in August, and Chris is here to tell us what we know.
Yeah, Pac-12 football games will return on November 6th. Each team will play a 7-game season, wrapping up on championship weekend, December 18th. The teams will play all division rivals and then two cross-division teams. Schedule is still being worked out, and even teams that don't make that title game will play a cross-division rival on that final weekend, too, so everyone will try to get that seventh game in. Here's Pac-12 Commissioner Larry Scott.
We know how badly our student-athletes want to compete as student-athletes for the Pac-12, but that we would only do so when we felt that we could do so safely.
So what changed over the last 3 or 4 weeks? Very simply, it was the ability to have rapid daily coronavirus testing for the athletes and staff. University of Oregon President Michael Schill says that was the key.
Over time, our medical advisory group became much more comfortable with our plans to resume.
And most Pac-12 cities are seeing a lull in cases, which also played a role. But for Commissioner Scott, it was the testing.
A couple of weeks ago, we announced a major breakthrough for us, which was access to daily testing, which was a critical factor to our medical advisory board being comfortable.
But all of this comes with a giant caveat. If there are outbreaks, the season could go away just as quickly as it started. There is a concern that not all teams will be able to play. For instance, right now, the county of Boulder, which is home to the University of Colorado, has banned gatherings of 18 to 22-year-olds. And that includes players getting together for practices or meetings, so they have an issue. There have also been so many student cases of coronavirus at Arizona that the school has opened up a second quarantine dorm. So we'll see how long this lasts. There have been nearly two dozen games canceled or postponed this season because of positive COVID tests, and these are the teams that were playing. I'm not talking about the ones where the seasons were canceled. So the conference says the return to play was not about recouping some of the millions of dollars it was losing, but of course when someone says it's not about the money, it's always about the money, and not coincidentally, the schedule allows the conference to get all of its TV money for conference play. Shortly after the Pac-12 announcement, the Mountain West announced its decision to return to play on October 24th with an 8-game schedule. Its plans are still subject to local health departments for approval. That includes teams like Boise State. Also read there will be no win requirement to make a bowl game this year. You normally need 6 games to qualify. This year it looks like it's open to anyone, so conceivably a winless team could still go bowling, which is good news for Oregon State and Washington State. And the Pac-12 also announced the dates of return of men's and women's basketball, whose seasons had been postponed. They set to begin on November 25th.
That's good. But still nobody in the stands, right?
That for the Pac-12, that is correct. For basketball, they're still working on that, but no fans in stands through the end of this year, I believe, for all sports.
Yeah. And by the way, what if it is about money?
It is all about money. It always has been.
But that's good. The money supports other sports, too. Money goes to people. People need money.
That is true. I mean, a lot of places, I mean, you look at Stanford. I mean, even with the kinds of endowment Stanford has, they cut so many programs, sports programs, this year for financial reasons. And you don't want to see that happen because the kids at every sport in every division have worked so hard to make it to play in college. I mean, to play in college, you're the top 10% of every high school athlete in America. Roughly for all sports. I mean, it takes a lot to get there, and to see this all go away has been pretty sad. I know Tommy's still mad that they're not going to be able to play this season, but he's at practice right now at Montana State, and they're still set to have a season in the spring, so we'll see how that goes.
All right.
It's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness, sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. By the way, the State Roofing text line, State Farm got a free ad from me today, but thank you. roof, we love to, you know, we all know the commercial.
It's you on that commercial? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's how I made all my money. I'm going to retire early. Anyways, I just wanted to make good on that. Now to the Daily Dose of Kindness. A father and son in Texas are helping feed kids in need during the pandemic. And CBS's Maria Villarreal has the story.
Good morning!
From 8 to 11, Keith Branch passes out meals.
I'll give you two just in case you want to air one later, okay?
Nourishment for the body and soul while remembering the golden rule and his faith.
He's not going to be thrilled with me when I don't do what I'm supposed to do.
Branch works with Kids Bring Life, a nonprofit intended to feed children facing food insecurity. However, with the pandemic and a stalled economy, millions of families find themselves in need of food. So Kids Bring Life began feeding children, young and old.
Give them to come in, Keith.
Branch and his 15-year-old son, Keith, give out 50 meals a day, 5 days a week. The organization has 40 locations around Dallas. Janelle Hicks is their operations manager.
How many a day?
We are doing about 2,000 to 3,000 a day. I see more people that are just thankful, some people that are using money for bills. Now they don't have to use it on the food.
How many meals do you eat?
How does it make you feel?
Makes me feel very good.
The coronavirus has given Keith Branch and his son the opportunity to practice what they preach by doing unto others while serving human kindness and love.
If you just believe that God put you out here for a purpose, you're going to inspire somebody.
You have a blessed day, okay?
A gold standard we could all live by. Mireya Villarreal, CBS News, Dallas.
From the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, right here on this radio station, here is G. Scott, who is, my sources tell me that you had a panic attack over this Dallas team that's coming to town.
Yeah, man, this Dallas team that's coming in town, it is good. Here's what it reminds me of. It reminds me of September, October of 2015, 5 years ago, when the Carolina Panthers came here. Cam Newton was the quarterback, and they got a win here at CenturyLink Field. That win, in my opinion, propelled the Carolina Panthers to an incredible season. They went to the Super Bowl, and that's when they lost to Peyton Manning and the Denver Broncos. This Cowboys team that's coming to town is kind of similar. Dak Prescott is their quarterback. Last week, he's the first quarterback in NFL history to throw for more than 400 yards and rush for more than 3 touchdowns. He's a really good quarterback. He's done everything he's supposed to do, but win the big time. And when I say the big time is to get into that class. Right now, he's been considered, he's really no match for Russell. As we all know, Russell Wilson is completing 75% of his passes. Russell Wilson is the best football player in football right now. He is the best quarterback. The dude is on fire. So when they come to town, guys, this is going to be a big game, and it's going to be a big win for one of the two. One of the two are going to be leaving this game with some serious confidence going forward. It's here at home, so of course we know how the Seahawks play at home. They play very well.
But they don't have the crowd behind them to play. I mean, isn't the crowd part of that?
Yes, Colleen, you're right. But there was something when I was at the game last on Sunday, Colleen. You're right. I was like, yo, this is eerie. It's quiet in here. You can hear everything. I'm like, yo, did he cough? Hey, wait, watch out.
That's really cool, though. I love it.
Like, yo, did he cough? But yeah. But here's the thing, though. Like, I it's the opposite. So check this out. Yeah, the defense needs the crowd. But something about Russell, when it's quiet, it's like, hey, listen, chill, man. The master is at work. He's concentrating. He is incredible. I think he's even better without the crowd. So, the guys, the Dallas Cowboys come in town. They got a run game. They got a quarterback. They got an offensive line. It's the Cowboys, right? There's a lot of people. I mean, there's a lot of Cowboy fans here in town.
They haven't been great in past seasons. I mean, they've been okay in past seasons. So what makes them so great now, especially since the Seahawks are undefeated. Russell's the best player in football right now. Mm-hmm. I don't understand this. You know, I hear Pete Carroll saying it's going to be a tough game. What?
It is going to be a tough game.
They always say that. What has he ever said this is going to be an easy game? We're just phoning it in.
Well,
does it make the victory more sweet when we undersell ourselves? I just don't understand what's going on. Where's the confidence? Usually I'm the one that's like, I don't know. Am I overconfident?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, a little bit. But I will say, victory does taste sweet. Yeah, like what's your go-to like on Sunday nights? Like you like brownies, like cupcakes? Because victory is sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyways. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me get back
nachos.
To it. You guys... Nachos with cheese on it, jalapenos?
Absolutely jalapenos.
Okay, let me get back to the topic. So, yes, Colleen, no, this team is, they're on the cusp, right? And that's why I started off by telling you guys that this game reminds me of when the Carolina Panthers came here. They weren't considered to be like, oh, they're going to be the Super Bowl contender. They was like, oh, it's the Carolina Panthers. It's going to be a good game with the Seahawks. And they barely got a win in against Russell Wilson and the Seahawks here in 2015. And again, they went on to win the rest of their games and, of course, losing to the Denver Broncos. So, look, let's have the Dallas Cowboys be who we thought they were, come to town, bunch of hype, Seahawks win, Seahawks 3-0. Dak Prescott feel sorry for him because if he goes back and he loses to Russell here, they are going to be mad. But just remember, the Dallas Cowboys, they did beat us in the playoffs a couple years ago.
Can I bring something up here? And I know that Russell Wilson may be the greatest quarterback in the league, but don't you have to give some credit to the people who catch the ball? Isn't that really difficult, what they do, as in they're running with their back to the quarterback, who's like 40 yards away, and they just sort of put up their hands, and the ball's right there. Plus, they're being chased by this big guy who's about to cream them, and they manage to hang on to it without dropping it. Doesn't that take a little bit of skill?
Hey, Dave, as the father of a wide receiver, I would love to just say, you know what? You're right. Their jobs are really tough. But the person that catches the ball, or excuse me, that receives the snap every single play, the person that is in control of the offense, the person who is just in control of everything, the tempo, the temperament on the sideline, nah, that Russell Wilson is a bad man right
now.
No
comparison, huh?
No, guys, he's so good right now that when he would get the ball and he'd snap the ball to him, the game slowed down even for me as I was watching. That's how good he is right now. Like, I don't know what's up with
him. So he can actually change the time-space continuum when he has the ball in his hand, is what you're saying.
Dave, see, man, you went all scientific on your boy.
He's going to be a physicist.
Just saying. All right.
Now he talks for a living. What's your score prediction, G?
Did you say talks from Boston?
Yeah.
Score prediction, I think it's going to be a shootout. I think 41-37 Seahawks. Yeah, I think this is going to be a shootout. Yeah.
Okay, 41-37. It's on the record. Thank you, G.
Mm-hmm. You can ring my bell. Ring your bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. In Tukwila, there is a restaurant incubator which specializes in helping women from all over the world start restaurants serving the kind of food that you don't normally get in this area. Here's Rachel Bell.
I first have to point out that this is the first time since March that I left the newsroom and brought my microphone out into public and interviewed people face-to-face with masks on. So this was a big occasion to get back out there and do an interview that wasn't on Zoom.
I'm cooking chicken for the empanadas for tomorrow. And onions, garlic. And,
Monica De Bartolomeo, an immigrant from Argentina, has a dream to open a bakery featuring the pastries and sweets from her home country.
The price of the kitchens, when you have to rent a kitchen, is very expensive and too risky, especially when you are starting.
So Monica, along with many other immigrant and refugee women of color, found a home in the incubator program at the Food Innovation Network.
The intent of the incubator program is to help folks that have not had access to commercial kitchens, have challenges navigating the permitting system. The incubator program provides services around business development as well as a commercial kitchen space. Even as English as my first language, I can tell you navigating permitting systems, it can be really confusing.
That's program director Kara Martin. For several years, the incubator program has helped immigrant and refugee women launch catering companies, create food products, and sell their food at farmers markets. But until now, they didn't have a permanent physical space. But now you can visit Spicebridge in its brand new building, complete with commercial kitchen.
Spicebridge is a global food hall here in Tukwila. We're a nonprofit running a food business incubator. So when you come in, you're supporting businesses that are just getting launched and have incredible culinary talents.
Spicebridge features 4 restaurant kiosks and 8 vendors that will rotate through. Some of the cuisine that is served there is not yet represented at any other restaurant anywhere in the region, like Caroline Musitu's Taste of Congo.
I'm making the food that's most popular in my country, Congo.
Caroline fled the Congo in 2009 with her husband and 2 children.
There is a war. There is no peace. That's why we came here. Yeah.
Her first job in Washington was in the Oberto warehouse in Kent. But thanks to the incubator program and Spicebridge, you can now taste her cooking.
That is like a big, big step. It's my dream.
Oh, that makes me so happy for you. How long have you had this dream?
I think since I was little, I was dreaming of.
Caroline says opening a restaurant has been her dream since she first started helping her mom cook as a little girl in Africa.
That's the bell pepper. I'm cutting for the
Umi Sala chops bell peppers in the Spicebridge kitchen for the dishes she'll be serving that day.
Jollof rice, chicken yassa, chicken dibi,
Omi cooks Gambian and Senegalese food with her sister, Adama Jame, for their catering company, Alefa Jollof.
I am from Gambia, West Africa. I came to the United States to better my future and change my life because I was going through a lot in there.
She left Gambia to leave a bad marriage behind.
You know, it's not easy sometimes with our husbands and the families. So that's why I am here.
Umi says she is forever grateful for the Food Innovation Network's help navigating the complicated system and helping her get a business off the ground.
These people are great. Yeah. If we have a word more than thank you, we will give it to them. They make everything possible for us. Till we come here, we were crawling until now, we are walking with our feet. And we are so proud of them. Everything is convenient for us here. So we have a very, very big thank you for them.
But the women also have stake in their success and help each other out as much as they can.
Could I get two of the veggie samosa and then a small cup of a jollof rice, please?
Eight vendors at Spicebridge means food from more than eight different countries, including Cambodia, Afghanistan, and a Tanzania, Somalia, and Kenya mashup. Here's Monica again.
The thing that I can say is that if you have a dream, just follow it. If you let your cook, just keep doing it. We spent more than 10 years trying to do this. And the day came and the dream came true.
Spicebridge is open 6 days a week in Tukwila. You can find more about it, the hours, the location at mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell.
A great idea, and you can hear the hope in their voices.
Mm-hmm. I want to eat there.
Tough time to open up a restaurant, though, that's for sure. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.